Hey everybody, welcome to TCP Talks with Jonathan Baker and Justin Broadley from the Cloud Pod. In this series, we're bringing you interviews with the best and brightest leaders and heroes from the tech and cloud industry.
Hey, good afternoon, Jonathan. How's it going?
Good, Justin. How about you?
It's fantastic. And, we've been talking on the main show quite a bit about cloud, hybrid cloud, multi-cloud, and even the idea of repatriating data back to the on-premise environment. And I just happened to have a guest for us today on TCP Talks that I think might be perfectly suited to talk about this exact topic. And I'd like to welcome to the show Travis Runty, CTO of Public Cloud at Rackspace Technologies. And I'll let you tell us a little bit more about yourself, Travis.
Fantastic. Thank you, Justin. Hey, so my name is Travis Runty. I'm the CTO of Public Cloud at Rackspace Technology. So I've been at Rackspace Technology for almost 17 years. I'm located in San Antonio, which is where our headquarters is. And you know, when I joined Rackspace almost 17 years ago, I joined as an entry-level Linux sysad. I love the open source community, I still do, but I wanted that to be my career. And so I jumped in and I had a blast for the last 17 years at Rackspace, defining all sorts of emerging technologies, going through hosting bare metal to virtualization to discussing what DevOps means to us to embracing the cloud and all of the great things that come along with it.
Rackspace and I have a long history, my 25-year career. I think I've been a customer at least a couple of times. I remember first being introduced to it by a blogger at the time. I think Robert Scoble was his name.
And Scobalizer?
Scobalizer blog, and I used to follow that pretty religiously back in my early tech days. And I remember when you converted a mall into a data center. So you guys have had a long, history, a long bit of knowledge in the space. Tell us a little bit about that journey, though. You came from basically the colo space or managed services colo space, and now I've come fully over to being a cloud service provider and being a partner of the public clouds. Tell me a little bit about that and that shift that you guys made.
Yeah, it's been a journey, and it's probably been specific phases along that journey. And so I remember a long, long time ago, literally, stacking white boxes on bread racks. That's where we started, right? And then from there, we matured to rack-mounted servers, introduced managed services. We had great partnerships with VMware. I launched a great VMware practice. At one point in time, we decided we were going to go head-to-head with the big hyperscalers. We're going to beat up on AWS, and we launched OpenStack. We didn't really beat up on AWS as part of that, but we had a good time. Ultimately what we did is we said, let's focus on the public cloud because there's a lot of opportunity there. And let's figure out how we can partner up with these hyperscalers. It's complicated for our customers to go along this journey successfully. The cloud is easy, but it's also complicated. And so how can we make sure that folks are able to realize the promise of the cloud the first time without a whole lot of rework, hopefully no rework, and a very, fun, engaging process along the way.
OpenStack was a fun period of time, especially living in the Bay Area during that. I go to startup meetups and I talk to people and they're like, oh yeah, we're huge into OpenStack and we're doing all this OpenStack. And I never really knew if it really extended far beyond the Bay and, tech startups that were really interested in it. Key companies like Rackspace. But, there's definitely some good technology that came out of it that still exists out there today. So, maybe it wasn't as successful as a hyper cloud provider or making your own version of it, but it definitely contributed a lot of really good technology to the business. So, we still thank you for your OpenStack contributions.
Oh, it was a great time. And I'll tell you, interestingly enough, we still have a strong OpenStack practice in our private cloud business. And without sharing too much, but without some of the discussions around VMware, we're seeing a lot of interest in the OpenStack platform.
Yeah, we've been talking quite a bit about Broadcom's acquisition of VMware on the main show. It's horror stories out of that. So yeah, definitely, you sort of wish now OpenStack maybe was a little bit more successful and, it's out there. But, there's competitive offerings and, it does have a place and still in some organizations. And that technology exists in KVM and others. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to see.
Yeah.
Who are you marketing to now? What's your approach in general to, acquiring customers and delivering what they need?
Yeah. So a reminder that Rackspace Technology has both a focus on private cloud and public cloud. So on the private cloud side, we have our VMware and our OpenStack practice. But on the public cloud side, what we do is we partner with the hyperscalers. We want to make sure that we're able to help the customers through their advisory elements, the transformational elements, as well as the manage and optimize. So what does that mean, right? Question is, we want to make sure that when a customer goes on their public cloud journey, that they actually have a robust strategy that is going to be effective. From there, we are able to leverage our professional services teams to make sure that they can realize that transformation. Hopefully it is a transformation, right? Hopefully it's not just a lift and shift. And then, you know, from there, from day two operations, we want to make sure we're there to help them manage the life cycle of it and ensure that it's continuously optimized from a technical, operational, and a financial point of view. When I think about the persona of the customer that, you know, we target, you know, we support customers all the way from commercial to mid-market, all the way up to enterprise. What really, really matters to us is they're looking for a partner, right? They need help, they want help, and we love helping people be successful in their journey.
Rackspace Technology has a huge history of providing managed services itself. So how do you think that's helped deliver the value that customers need in moving to public cloud?
Yeah. So you're right. That's our lineage is in day two operations, right? Managed services. And so I think one of the unique ways that we approach our guidance and a transformation as we help customers on their journey through public cloud. I don't know of many shops or many service providers that will help you with the strategy, will implement that strategy, and is happy living with and maintaining the entire life cycle of that strategy. All right, so if we're going to recommend an architecture, how to design a COE, what technologies we're going to introduce into that and help you realize those technologies, it's with the mind or the mindset that we need to be successful from a from a technically sustainable point of view. Because when we build it, when we design it, we are fully expecting to live with it through the entire life cycle. And we know how to operate, by the way. So that's key.
It's interesting, take on it, because there's a big push in a lot of, you know, technology companies or ISV companies to do more of you build it, you run it development, you know, full DevOps stacks, full CI/CD. And then we push a lot of the day two operational work onto the dev teams. And there's this balance that has to be struck between running day two operations and then also developing new code. And do you see that scenario that Rackspace typically comes in and helps the organizations kind of mature through that cycle? Or do you see that there's sort of a backlash against some of that move to dev to do everything?
I see no backlash, right? I see only opportunity, but I see a lot of different approaches as part of it. And so, you know, some of the scenarios that we see is customer has their current stack, their current environment, and they want to modernize. But reality is through that transformation period, it's really, really tough to have to maintain two environments, a workforce that's having to do two different things, two different types of support. And so, you know, a real unique, I'll say, value that we can provide there is one of two scenarios, right? One is the customer wants to upskill their workforce and transform to the new workload or their new modernized stack. And so we'll take on that legacy workload so that their team can focus on tomorrow. But then on the flip side, we also see a customer saying, you know what, Rackspace, you see these cutting edge technologies. You deploy this on a regular basis. We would like for you to deploy your opinionated stack, get it up to a state that's effective, operational, and then upskill our workforce so that we can take it over a period of time. Reality is, I think both are right. It really just depends on how the customer wants to approach it.
Do you see yourself as providing sort of a Rackspace flavored platform on top of other public clouds, or are you sort of just providing advice and then sort of handing it off to the customer?
It's definitely more than advice. Going back to a bit of an open source mindset, I think maybe a conflict that we continuously have to strike the balance of is when do we apply a cloud native solution and where do we apply the Rackspace elements on top of it? The hyperscalers technologies are the best there are. We're probably not going to create a better version of X than AWS does, nor do we want to, right? They're already doing a great job. But we want to make sure that we're able to implement the services, the best practices, the discipline, the COE structure, the governance, right? Understanding who your stakeholders are, and then also leverage some IP and assets that we have to help manage that either within a single platform or across multiple platforms.
As you think about helping customers embrace public cloud, either be AWS or GCP, and you know, you're talking about your love of open source, does Rackspace end up providing some of this as open source people can take advantage of, or is it typically something you get through your partnership only?
So any professional services engagements that we do, that's the customer's IP, right? If we built it through them and they paid for that, then it's theirs to reuse however they want. We're not going to put a wall behind over between the IP and what they've paid for and keep it to ourselves. But there are some elements that for our managed services where we think really does give us a differentiator. We'll call it a bit of a fabric, right? Our Rackspace fabric, where we can consolidate IAM, consolidate billing, consolidate, you know, troubleshooting or ticket escalations. And so that's like the degree in which we want to provide our flavor on that experience. But that's more so on the interaction and the interoperability, not necessarily the technology layer, I would say.
Do you think that's really what differentiates you from other cloud partners?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we favor cloud native, right? Every single time we're gonna favor the platform's native solution. I think that unless the customer has a really, really strong opinion about being vendor locked, right? Which sometimes they do. And if that's the case, then we could establish a solution that gives them that portability. But I think that for right now, the customers are generally preferring cloud native solutions, and that's where the training's at, that's where the enablement's at, that's where the funding is at, and it's currently, in my opinion, one of the most graceful paths.
Do you think they're preferring cloud native solutions because of the lower operational burden or something else?
Yeah, I think that, one, there's the most information out there about them, right, for the most part. They likely have strong partnerships within the hyperscaler. The hyperscalers are fighting for workloads like crazy right now, right? And so they're willing to fund POCs, fund, you know, migrations, fund transformations for that matter. And so guess what? They want you to use their solution as part of that. So I'm sure they're being influenced there as well.
That makes sense. You mentioned vendor lock-in a second ago, and that's one of our check it off on the bingo card kind of thing, along with multi-cloud. From the customers who approach you looking for help, do you find that more or less customers are really concerned with vendor lock-in?
Yeah, I would say increasingly, I see customers that are more aware of it. You know, I wouldn't say that they're afraid of it or they're even avoiding it, but when they embark upon situations or solutions where that is the case, they're intentional about it and they're accepting it. I think that there is increasing awareness about accepting those decisions and the potential, you know, repercussions of what those could mean down the road. But I don't necessarily see people's or customers' behaviors changing.
You know, and you do have a customer who's coming in. If it's not vendor lock-in, they're concerned about what's the big driver for them to be multi-cloud.
I will say that I find very few customers that are truly multi-cloud. And we spend a lot of time defining what multi-cloud means, right? For me, multi-cloud does not mean that you have two different business units that happen to operate in different clouds. When I say multi-cloud, I mean a common workload that can span or be portable to multiple clouds. And I see very, very, very few customers that have the need, let alone the expertise and operational discipline to be effective in a common workload spanning multiple platforms.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience as well. I mean, there's isolated cases where, you know, you're a SaaS provider and you want to sell to customers and, you know, maybe you have a big data transfer cost. So I look at like APM vendors, for example, are a great example of this, where they have a large data ingestion need. And so if they can put it into the same cloud as their customer, then they can avoid some of the cross, you know, egress charges of that and help save their customer money. So that's, I see those being drivers more on like SaaS companies than I do necessarily on most traditional IT organizations. But yeah, it is interesting, you know, how it's kind of morphed into this thing is like, well, you have to be multi-cloud and you have to be doing these things because if you don't, you get locked in, and then they get locked in, then they're going to increase the price on you. And it's like, well, other than Google recently, cost, you know, hasn't really changed much for the clouds. I guess even IPv4 charging now for Amazon is another one, but you know, very rarely have costs gone up in the cloud from what we've seen traditionally. And so it feels a little bit like marketing people trying just to put doubt in people's minds about certain providers. But it is sort of interesting, you know, that the reality is that most of the time people don't have the need for multi-cloud and that single workload, multiple clouds.
Yeah, I would agree. I'll say a real scenario that I came across recently is I was meeting with a bunch of customers in Calgary, Canada, AWS customers in Calgary, Canada, and Calgary only had until recently a Far East region, right? They didn't have a West region. And so they were having to go into Seattle or leverage an Azure platform. And so it was kind of a regional component from a latency perspective, which made perfect sense. I'll also say that when I talk to customers a lot and they say they're multi-cloud, what they mean is that they're accidentally multi-cloud, right? They had business units go rogue, or they've done acquisitions and their portfolio just continuously sprawled one way or the other, but it was absolutely not a strategy. It was just a result.
Yeah. Yeah. I the old adage back probably when you and I were still doing Linux system admin work was, you know, for every nine of availability, you know, it's about $1 million in cost you would incur in your data center. And I sort of have that same adage now for multi-cloud. For every cloud you want to add, you're probably adding millions of dollars in cost, you know, to do abstraction, to make sure things work. And while the cloud providers providing you tools, in some cases like Anthos or EKS Anywhere, et cetera, you know, there's really, you know, you're really restricting what you can do without having to do a lot of major middle layer work that I think companies don't realize how expensive that is and how much work it actually takes to get done.
Yeah, you're right. What ends up happening is in a lot of those situations, you likely avoid a lot of the hyperscaler native, cloud native solutions, right? You're pretty much just using compute, using Prior containers. And you know, some of that abstraction is inconsistent. And so there's some trade-offs being made there for sure.
So as you talk to customers about, you know, maybe starting their journey, I don't know how many customers you actually talk to about just starting at this point. But you know, for customers who are thinking about moving large workloads to cloud and they're looking at Rackspace to help them do that, what kind of tooling can you bring to them in terms of migration? You know, which is really one of the hardest things about getting to the cloud is just getting there to begin with.
Yeah. So I do talk to a lot of customers that are just beginning that migration. You'd be surprised how many customers are still running on-prem. I don't mean private cloud. I mean it within their own data centers. You know, I know the work that goes into managing your own data center. It sounds like a nightmare to be a small shop having to manage your own data center. But I understand some folks have a need for it. But yeah, so when, you know, a customer comes to us and say, we're starting this journey, you know, the things that we would look at is, you know, what are some of the tools that we can drop into your vCenter or within your network to really trace the relationships, the utilization, and let's really establish what we think that cost is going to be. Each of the hyperscalers has recommendation engines and cost engines. I'll tell you, they're generally fairly generous on some of their projections. So we like to use a third party one where we can control that a little bit more. And that actually also helps us not necessarily go into a multi-cloud solution, but fairly evaluate each of the hyperscalers to identify the best solution from a technology and cost perspective.
The cloud vendors are actually snapping up migration tools left and right. I think Cloud Endure was one that AWS bought. TSL Logic, I think, was another one. They seem to be very niche use cases. I can't imagine, I mean, myself, I can't imagine ever wanting to live migrate a running Windows server from a data center to a cloud region. Are people actually doing that?
There's a period of time, it was probably 3, 4, 5 years ago when, you know, we were suggesting lift and shift, just get to the cloud, right? Get to the cloud and we can talk about your transformation. For the last couple of years, I've been saying lift and shift is not the way, right? If you're going to use your public cloud platform as an IaaS, you're going to get stuck there, right? I think that customers should be a lot more intentional, workload specific, and figure out how static is your workload. Let's figure out where the best infrastructure is for that workload and what sort of investment modernization are you willing to tolerate to figure out how we can make a targeted transformation to the right platform. I think just blanket saying AWS is our platform, AWS is our new infrastructure, or Google or wherever, is probably not a super strong IT strategy. It can be very, very cost exhaustive, we'll say.
Yeah, it's having done lift and shift now and hybrid, I sort of now say hybrid is the way to go. Like, take specific workloads, take greenfield applications that you want. You can write cloud native, that you can take advantage of it. You know, yeah, you might have to go pay for Megaport or one of these other vendors to put a, you know, a line between your data center or colo facility and into there, but you know, there's a lot of legacy technology that lives on premise that is hard and expensive to shift to the cloud. And then if you're not willing to make that transformation as you go, the costs once you get there are so high that you know, your CFO gets mad at you. The stock market probably gets upset as well. And then, you know, you're in a situation where you're trying to optimize while you're migrating and dealing with a lot of challenges around that. You know, it's interesting, you know, thinking about hybrid applications and stuff. How do you see AI kind of starting to come into this mix with customers? You know, everyone, if you're on the public stock market, you're doing something with AI because otherwise your valuation is getting clipped right now. You know, how do you see that changing how people are thinking about going to hyperscalers?
Yeah, I think the opportunity that the hyperscalers provide to leverage the models in a very affordable and accessible way, I mean, that value right there is pretty undeniable. I think the question is, you know, where do you leave your data, right? How securely, how cost effectively can you provide access to that data? For me, it becomes less about is a hyperscaler the right choice or not, because we know, I think in all those scenarios, the hyperscaler is probably the right solution. It comes down to your design and how hybrid are you willing for it to be. I think that AWS and Google's decisions recently to eliminate or reduce exfil bandwidth charges really, really changes that conversation in a positive way. I'm hoping Microsoft follows suit. And so I think that the hybrid environment is probably the right solution for most of those scenarios, we'll say.
Got it. Makes sense. You know, thinking about this cost side, AI, you know, moving workloads lift and shift, I feel like that's probably the biggest driver behind what we're seeing as kind of the repatriation movement, really driven by companies like Basecamp or 37 Signals, you know, the parent company of them. You know, Twitter, of course, and Elon Musk's, you know, saying cloud is too expensive, I'm going to move all this to my own servers. You know, you guys kind of sit in an interesting place where you run both colo and you run public cloud workloads. You know, Is there fire there, or is just a lot of smoke and people who with big personalities talking about it?
I think the hybrid solution is absolutely a leading IT strategy. I really do. And by the way, we provide more than colo on our private cloud side, right? We provide full private cloud solutions, managed solutions. And so, you know, I think that managing each of those on their own is complex. Managing both of those in a, you know, hybrid environment is increasingly complex. But I think that as long as you're conscious of which technologies you introduce to your stack, you know exactly where your perimeter is, and you have a strong observability tool to truly manage that on a real-time basis, I think it can be a pretty successful strategy. I see no reason why you would put a static workload in the public cloud. I don't understand why you would do that. I think that's a great, one of many great use cases to continue to leverage private cloud storage, right? Even if you are doing a multi-cloud strategy, having your storage centrally located somewhere else, it can still create value there as well. So I think there's a lot of good reasons to go hybrid.
What sort of questions do you ask customers when deciding where to point them? I mean, there's some easy answers. You know, if you're a Microsoft shop, Azure's the way to go. If you're running .NET apps at scale, Azure's probably the way to go. But are there any sort of differentiators which are on your mind when a customer approaches you and asks you for some advice around that?
Yeah, you know, I think there sometimes is. I'll tell you, very rarely when a customer engages us, do they not have a strong opinion. Do you either have a previous relationship or they have some sort of agreement already in place and they want to continue there? And so you mentioned, you know, do you already have a relationship? That is absolutely something that we ask. Also talk about the skill set, right, of your workforce. Where is your team already invest in workforce enablement? Are you already halfway down the path on Microsoft or Azure? Then let's just keep that going, right? Because reskilling a workforce is really, really complicated. That's half the battle. And so I think taking there's of course, you know, technical reasons, right, that we evaluate to help a customer come to a decision there, but that may be less than half of the equation, I think it's the relationships. I think it's the workforce. And I think maybe even the incentives that the technology or the platform may have available to them at the time. And the long-term vision, right? Where do you see yourself? And does your vision align with that hyperscaler's vision as well?
You mentioned workforce, and that's obviously a huge challenge, especially for people transforming from an on-prem environment, completely different set of skills, especially infrastructure as code, or you know, even training developers in cloud-native tooling. I see a lot of things in the news about, you know, the huge workforce gap. You know, there's millions more people needed, whether it's information security or any other particular role. Do you feel that people are driven towards Rackspace for the help they can provide because of the lack of people in the workforce? Or is it really because of the sort of the more comprehensive assistance that you can give because of your experience?
Yeah, I don't think there's a shortage of talented folks available. Might be a shortage of people willing to pay for it, which is different though, right? And I say that because sometimes when our customers come to us, two things, right? One is they don't want to have to learn it on the fly and have to redo it and make some mistakes and have to go through it the hard way. They want someone who's done it before, can get them there the most gracefully, effectively as possible. But there are also a lot of situations where you need deep level expertise for a period of time. Say you're going to establish a full, you know, data governance strategy. That's probably a full-time job, but you know, it's also a hard time to get started, right? And maybe you need to burst or surge the capacity or expertise to get you on your road there. And so I'd say the biggest thing that our customers come to us for is a burst in expertise or a sort of a time element of expertise. They don't want to have to hire that very, very, very expensive team member for a project that they're only going to be needing them for, you know, 3 to 6 months. I'll say also that, you know, some of our offerings we're able to do is collapse a lot of those skill sets into a single engagement. And so we have an offering called Elastic Engineering where it gives you a team of like 9 team members that are, say, diversified in their skill sets and their backgrounds. And so for a single hourly fee on a recurring basis, you're able to access a security expert, a data expert, infrastructure expert, kind of as you need, when you need. That flexibility is quite unique. Otherwise, that would be 3 to 5 additional skill sets you would have to hire full time.
You're exposed to a lot of really cool use cases. And, you know, I remember a long list of solution white papers and customer highlights of success. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about one that you find interesting personally that you worked on or were involved in that you think, you know, was really interesting for some of the reasons we talked about, be it the hybrid story or, you know, some of these other areas around AI and enabling, you know, more of the multi-cloud story.
Yeah, I can't mention the customer's name, but the scenario is they were a longtime private cloud customer. And I mean, such a long time where I helped build some of the servers a long time ago for them, right? And you know, reality is they were beginning their public cloud journey and they wanted help. And so it is one of many hybrid customers that we maintain, right? We help them through that. And they're continuing to be a hybrid customer. And so I think that seeing them do it and being a part of it to help them ensure that they're effective, that they evaluate which solution makes sense for the right workload, has been really, really fun to see. It's a customer who was private cloud forever. They were getting pressures to go public cloud, and they were very responsible on how they chose to go down that path. And because of that, and they, you know, they chose a good partner, Rackspace. And you know, I think that their first attempt to leverage, to burst, or to pick specific workloads into public cloud was ultimately successful. I think that when a customer can find the help that they want and not have to go through the turmoil and rework and drama of having to reconsolidate and, you know, salvage your stakeholders' confidence, I think is a really exciting thing to be part of.
Great. That's a great use case. So I know Jonathan asked you when you're talking to customers about, you know, what cloud you steer them towards, and you said it's more of a preference. Which one do you like? Which one is your favorite?
I can't answer that one. I don't think. I'll tell you from a user point of view. for me that I feel the most comfortable in the Google platform. I don't know why, right? But it just feels the most intuitive to me. From a capabilities perspective, though, you know, I think that, and from a relationship perspective, you know, AWS is hard to beat.
Yeah, yeah, I really do like the Google Console as well. It just it seems organized the way my brain works. Maybe it's because I came from a bunch of Linux guys, and so we're coming from that Linux admin. We're like, oh, this is how I think as a Linux guy, and that's why the console resonates to me. And then Amazon, you know, earlier on, I'd say it was pretty easy to navigate, but it's gotten super complex because, you know, when you have 180 some odd services, you know, how do you do discovery and those things? And we won't talk about queue and what they've done with that, but, you know, it's been, it's sort of interesting to see them evolve. But, yeah, the one that I still struggle with every time I get into Azure, just trying to use their console, because the way they think about things is just completely foreign to how I think about technology and systems. And like once you get it, it makes sense, but like there's a bit of a hurdle there in my opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd be willing to bet that if we asked a Windows engineer, you know, they might feel a lot more comfortable naturally in the Azure platform than maybe you and I.
And they do, and that is very true. So. Yeah. So thinking about, you know, the next few years ahead, you know, we're coming hopefully out of an economic downturn, you know, once the election gets passed and all the other fun that's happening in the world. You know, what's the future look like for roadmap for Rackspace though? And, you know, from a roadmap perspective, innovations, what you're excited about coming up, you can talk about.
Yeah, so I think I would be the first person to mention this, but AI is a big topic right now among every customer conversation. And so, you know, I think that customers spent a lot of energy over the last year reacting to what AI means for them. You know, I think that they naturally take it to a data conversation. And then what that does is it shines a spotlight on how effectively is your data organized, right? Is your data usable? How secure is your platform, right? What best practices do you have? What security tools are you using? How is your network designed? And so I think that the future is ensuring that our customers have the architecture either built or evolved to leverage all of these capabilities effectively. I also think that in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll see a surge of edge, right? I think that we're going to see a lot more customers willing to do on-prem appliances, IoT, and the discipline or the skill set that it's going to take to manage that is going to be really, really interesting, right? It feels like a combination between a public cloud and a private cloud. Best practices, right? Distributed system, those that are still kind of hands-on and tangible. So I think that it's going to be a really cool opportunity there.
Is Kubernetes going to die? We've been hoping for a couple of years now, but it doesn't look like it.
You don't know it's going to die. We just hope that it becomes less of a topic. Like just, you know, because VMware was really exciting when it first started, then it kind of, you know, became just part of the natural dial tone of infrastructure. Yeah. And I think we're kind of waiting for that point for Kubernetes where it becomes less finicky and less you know less knobs to turn into something people can use without thinking about it. And I say this as a major Amazon ECS fanboy, and still use ECS for all my personal projects, just because I you know why I like Kubernetes and I respect what it does. There's a lot of knobs and a lot of complexity, and that complexity kills in a lot of organizations.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's fair. I do think it'll persist. I think it'll become more accessible maybe or simple but yeah I think it'll absolutely continue to persist. I think especially at the edge it becomes more useful even.
Yeah, you mentioned the edge a couple times. What are you thinking about the edge? I know we've been keeping a close eye on what Cloudflare is up to. We've been watching, you know, Lambda at the edge and CloudFront, you know, capabilities are coming out. You know, they seem to be the leaders in this by Amazon and Cloudflare and on the edge computing. We're seeing a little bit from Azure, we're seeing a little bit from Google, but what do you think about it? It's sort of an interesting paradigm.
Yeah, I think that when I think about the edge, I think of a very low barrier of entry from a hardware cost perspective. I think about a gas station, right? And they have, you know, two servers that's, you know, hosting, you know, their entire workload. I don't know that anyone's dominating that specific space quite yet. I see a lot of non-hyperscalers being quite competitive there. I see some really neat wrappers around, you know, pretty crisp traditional stacks that make it quite accessible for folks. And I think that's just going to continue to streamline and become more of a dominant motion.
Yeah, one of the things that we've talked about on the show a couple times is, you know, thinking of from an application design perspective and how you code and develop, like, you know, the ability to segment your application into edge versus semi-edge versus core, I think is probably the biggest burden that I continue to see developers struggling with. And so I'm kind of waiting for those tools to come that'll help kind of make it easier for developers to parse out the different components between the edge and the non-edge. But I do, it is an interesting area, and especially with the advent of AI and robotic technology and IoT, it gets really interesting really quickly, especially when you're talking about manufacturing floors and what they can do. There's lots of really cool use cases there, so I'm glad to hear you guys see that as something coming down the road as well.
Yeah, I think I'm excited about it. I think it'll be probably the next major, we'll say, disruptor.
You know, other than AI, do you think there's anything else that's really disruptive coming in tech at this point? You know, using your crystal ball a little bit.
You know, we talk a lot about the citizen developer, you know, using low-code, no-code solutions. I still think that folks are cautious about, you know, the concept of a citizen developer. We spend a lot of time talking about tech debt. And, you know, when I think about an army of people that can create their own, you know, micro apps or, you know, queries or views or whatever, for me, that sounds quite terrifying. I think that done right, we might see a responsible citizen developer that we can enforce, you know, appropriate standards, but also provide the accessibility that the promise of the citizen developer can deliver.
Yeah, we've sort of had the stance at the CloudPod that, you know, AI is really the final piece to making low code, no code actually function, because the a lot of the walled gardens were great if you had a very simple use case. But then as soon as you hit an edge, that was a sharp edge, and there was no way forward without calling up a developer and saying, hey, code me something. And so, you know, I think, you know, the Vavin being able to go to the, you know, to the LLM and ask it to do some of that lifting, I think solves one of the big challenges of low code, no code traditionally. And so I sort of find it interesting that Amazon kind of has abandoned it, at least with their Gen 1 version of low code, no code with Honeycode. Because I do think it could be really interesting in the future, but, you know, what that looks like quite yet isn't defined, but I think it's coming. I kind of agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, it'll be interesting to see what that means for that, that persona, right? I don't know what a developer looks like in the future. I think it'll be very different than what it looks like today. I mean, they'll be absolutely needed. We'll need experts and specialists, but it'll just look very different.
I have that conversation with my son all the time. He's very interested in, you know, writing computer games and these things. And I'm like, yeah, as long as you're, you know, into 3D vector graphics and, you know, that side of it, I think you're probably okay for now. But, you know, like the basic scaffolding of a gaming engine, you know, that stuff's going to kind of just disappear more and more as AI replaces that. So it'll be interesting for him more than me, because I'll hopefully be retired.
Yeah, I agree on the citizen developer thing. In fact, I think it'll kind of go a step further than even considering them as developers. It'll be sort of like an open access way of creating workflows or sort of interactive frameworks which don't ever require code. It's not that they're low code. It's just that we'll be talking to a model, and the model in a way will be the operating system itself, and, you know, the person who's doing the coding will be providing the system instructions and maybe some test cases and say, when I ask you to do this, then do this. And I don't think we'll ever see code again either, but, yep. at least for that sort of that class of application.
Not as we know it.
Yeah, so looking forward to the Star Trek voice and interacting with the computer that way though.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, if people are find this interesting and they want to learn more about Rackspace or follow, you know, the tech blogs at Rackspace, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah. So www.rackspace.com. You can also, you know, access me on LinkedIn, Travis Runty. I'm always available. I'm very responsive, and you know, I'm happy to share, you know, what I see. Right. I think that going back to our community, open source sort of roots, it means a lot to me to share and to learn. And by surrounding myself with folks who are going through their journey, that are going through challenges and understanding what's working and what's not working for them, I'm able to share the same. And, you know, I'm not looking for a customer relationship there, unless you want, right? I'm just happy to support the community.
Well, fantastic. And you said at the beginning of the show you're going to be at Next. So
I will.
If you're there and you've listened to the show, and check out Travis and the team at Rackspace or any of the other many cloud events that are happening around the world, as Rackspace is at all of them these days.
We are. Yeah. We'll be at Next and we'll be at all of them. Yeah. And there'll be a great team at Next for sure. In 2 weeks now?
Right, about 2 weeks. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. We appreciate it. And really interesting conversation. And look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yeah. Thank you both.
Thanks, Travis. Visit thecloudpod.net to subscribe to the show, join our Slack channel, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also find information on reaching our audience through a CloudPod sponsorship opportunity. A big thank you to today's guest, and thank you for listening.